Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report, your source for libertarian commentary on current events in the Ocean State and Southern New England. Coming to you from Rothbard Studios.
And we are back. It's been a long break. We've been away for a while, and we're finally relaunching the podcast. So a couple of changes. Eric, who was my co-host previously, has kind of stepped back. He's got some family obligations going on and new additions to the family and work commitments and whatnot. So Eric's kind of taken a little bit of a break, and Eric's part of the family. So there's no hard feelings there. He's always welcome back, and he may even come back at some point to join the team again. But the exciting news is we have two new co-hosts. We've got Bill and Sean. So some of you may know Bill. Bill's been a candidate for office here, longtime libertarian in Rhode Island, a very active libertarian, and Sean as well. Sean's a former Navy veteran, or is a Navy veteran, and also a active libertarian. So welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us, Mike. And yeah, it's going to take two of us to fill Sean's Eric's shoes up, but for sure. So we're excited to be on board and doing our best to keep up with him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's good stuff. And we're going to have fun. And just like, as always, the previous podcast is a conversation and us talking about different stuff going on. We're not in Rhode Island, and having fun conversations and maybe ruffling a few feathers on the in the duopoly and the progressives and whatnot within the state. So it's always a good time. I figured before we get started on our typical topics, a couple of housekeeping items, since it's been so long and some of them are major events. One of the biggest one is that we've been zucked on Facebook. So back in February, our Facebook page, which was well above 5,000 likes, was depublished or unpublished. So we lost that mechanism to reach out to people. So, you know, we always knew what happened. We tried to prepare ourselves a little bit for it with a shadow page, which we do have and is up and running. So we still have a Facebook presence, although we have to rebuild it. But in true libertarian fashion, our solution to the problem was to start our own social community. And we've done that with libertyri.net. And it's a very much a social style community. So if you're used to a Facebook type interface, it's very much like that, where you can join in and there's an activity wall. You can post links and memes and, you know, topics for discussion. You can friend people. You can join groups or you can start a group. So all that good stuff. So we really want people to go over there to libertyri.net. It's something that we own, we control. And it's growing. So yeah, so we want to push everybody towards that direction. That way we can always stay in contact.
And all are welcome for sure. So any, all political stripes are more than welcome to come and discuss your ideas and, you know, join the, and, you know, these sites live on content. So the more people we can get interacting, the better the site's going to be for everyone involved.
Yeah. So I want to talk about a quick use case of that, right? So with a lot of the Second Amendment stuff, we found a lot of people kind of gravitating these types of forms, especially with Facebook kind of controlling the narrative on, you know, content that's going around, especially now in recent, you know, national events on the Second Amendment. So it's a small group right now. It's got a lot of unique perspectives on it. So definitely looking forward to connecting with people over.
Yeah, that's a good point, Sean, too, because that's something that worries me specifically on the Second Amendment community within Rhode Island. Most of our connection is through Facebook, right? Like there's a handful of groups for Rhode Islanders in there, but if that goes away, there's nothing. It's very difficult for us all to reconnect. And I actually really want, and it's a big issue for me, I've talked about it a lot in past podcast episodes. Gun rights has always been one of my pet issues, if you will. And losing connection it would really, really hurt us. So there's a huge open invite to the Second Amendment community we want to reach out to go there, start your own groups there, and it's, you know, nobody's going to shut you down. So we'll all stay connected. So that's really important.
Yeah. It's hard for all the yellow shirts to get together now, right? You can't go to any open sessions anymore. It's all virtual.
It works a lot the regular Facebook and social media, the interaction, the likes, you can share content, links, everything you want. The big difference is, though, Mike, is that there's no algorithm censoring the content. You're getting a stream of what's available from people who are in your community, who you can choose to add to your community, or who you can choose to block or anything like that. But it's a completely libertarian space, and we're not manipulating what you see. Everything on there are people who are contributing from the state of Rhode Island.
Yep, for sure. And it's like I said, it's something we control, and it's going to improve over time. The more people join, obviously the content improves, but the features of the site are going to improve as well. And it's something we're really working hard on. So we really want it to grow.
And it's absolutely
we'll be talking
free,
about it.
Right. That's that, you know, it doesn't cost us anything.
Completely free. Exactly. So, so on that note, something else I wanted to talk about was just to stay connected. It's always important. And we'll mention it again at the end of the show here, but, if you go to libertyri.com/connect, there's our contact page there. You can shoot us an email through that page. Our social media links are there as well. Join our newsletter, get on the email list. Again, very important, so we all can stay in touch and keep that connection regardless of what happens on social media. So that's very important. And we'll hit that up again at the end. But, again, very libertarian, right? So we want to control our own destiny and create our own options for people. And something else that's very, very libertarian is my roads, right? Libertarians love their roads, or I shouldn't say that. We're always getting attacked about who will build the roads, right? And come to find out, the government doesn't do a very job building roads as it is. And Sean's got a lot of interesting insight in that. If Sean wants to take the first topic today and talk about our beautiful road infrastructure here in Rhode Island.
Yeah, absolutely. So everyone listening knows that, you know, as you're driving to work, you know, the roads aren't that good in Rhode Island. And the White House actually just made a statement about that and some of the new legislation that they're trying to pump out for the next Biden administration stimulus, you know, the infamous infrastructure and build jobs acts, right? So the White House released a ranking of every single state in terms of their infrastructure, and Rhode Island got a C-. It's very interesting that years and years of Democratic leadership in Rhode Island would give us a grade like that, you know. So just a couple of details that I kind of want to read.
Hey, it's from better than our schools, Sean, for sure. So
oh boy, yeah. So right from the report, they indicated that there are 148 bridges and over 860 miles of highway in poor condition in Rhode Island. A couple other stats: since 2011, commute times have increased by over 10% on average, and each driver pays $845 a year in costs due to driving on our horrible roads, right? So, well, you know, it's a lot of numbers there, but if you actually look at the amount of roadway that we have in Rhode Island, it's quite shocking, right? So I said 860 miles of highway are in poor condition. You know, we only have 1,100 miles of roadway. So 78% of all of our roads are in poor condition. So if this costs us millions and millions of dollars and we get a lot of payments like that, where's the money going, right? It's all coming in. You know, I was reading a tweet by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse on it, and he's like, you know, we're making progress on these types of things, but we need this American Jobs Plan to get our roads into shape. And probably about a year ago, he was a part of the committee that passed $1.4 billion to Rhode Island. So, you know, there's a lot of money there. And I kind of went down the rabbit hole when I was looking at this, and these infrastructure and road plans sounded very, very familiar. And we've gotten multiple grants in the past 2 years, specifically for our crumbling bridges. And here we are getting even more money on a lot of the things. And when we look at infrastructure in Rhode Island, it's real funny to think about, because every single politician loves to talk about it. It's an easy thing to point to, right? You can say, oh yeah, the roads are horrible, so we need money for this. We need the Rhode Island DOT to get the appropriate investments. We haven't gotten enough investments, and we need all of these different things to really start to champion those types of improvements. You know, some of my favorite projects that come to mind that we spent money on is the $3 million pedestrian walking bridge in Providence that blew up to $22 million in cost. That was a Cicilline item, right? And his predecessors inherited that, and now it's doing a lot of good in Rhode Island, right? So, you know, it's interesting that a very small project like that could not be managed by the state, and it continued to grow and grow. And a lot of that is because of the monopoly that Rhode Island has on those types of things, on those types of projects. And a lot of the times it's just a money transfer. You look at all the different awards that the Rhode Island DOT puts out, and it's really concerning, the money that goes out, but you don't see it. You don't get put into practice, right? 78% of our roads were deemed by the Biden administration. Yeah.
Well, Sean, I watched Gene Valicenti. I listen to Gene Valicenti on Thursday mornings with the DOT director, Peter Alvidi, and he says everything's on a 10-year plan. Like, I thought we were right on, no pun intended, the road to recovery over here. What's taking so long with this stuff? And why is this the work not getting completed?
So, you know, what's even more concerning is that we have the Rhode Island DOT director on the radio every Thursday, that the conditions of the road are so bad that we just got to talk to the guy directly. I don't know of any other state that has their director of transportation talk about the roads. It's because they want to hold accountability, right? Because people are getting fed up with this stuff. Looking at any of our roads, and we're not the only ones looking at this. You know, there have been numerous reports of Rhode Island having the absolute worst. We've rated it in the last out of many states in both our urban roads, rural roads, bridges, things like that. And it's really, really concerning to see that everyone is saying our roads are so horrible, but it can't just be money, right? It can't be money that solves the problem. We've been pumping money into it for years. You know, Roadworks, that's another program that I believe was supposed to, you know, last 5 years. So he's got a 10-year plan, but, you know, I don't think that he's going to, you know, the objective of Roadworks is in 5 years, 90% of our roads are going to be A-okay again. Well, I don't see that happening when in 2021, 78% of our roads are in disrepair. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. And something interesting too, I wonder where these contracts for road construction are going, right? It's always the same companies that get the contracts, which is, I also find interesting, right? It's never, I guess there's Rhode Island being such a small state, there's probably only so many construction companies that are large enough to actually do the construction. But I mean, I guess that goes to say, why does it have to be the government that manages it? Because obviously they can't manage it. Like they're not doing a very, very good job at it. And the fact we're such a small, tiny state, it's amazing.
It's amazing that the
work, you know,
the work that they do is so poor, dealing with these, you know, the higher DOT guys that come and actually do the work, and then they end up contracting, like Mike's point, to outside third parties anyway. What the heck are they contributing to the process besides the bureaucracy of trying to run the government itself? And Sean, I mean, but you mentioned the grants earlier. And last time I checked, there's these great truck tolls that are on the highway. Yeah, are we not spending enough money per mile of road to get a return on our investment?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because every time that I hear about it, you know, they say, oh, no, we don't have to worry about the truckers going around us. We're making plenty of money on all these things. But actually, that stuff is still in court. You know, it's under federal appeal. To try to overturn some of these things, you know, it's been deemed in a couple communities as being very unconstitutional what they're trying to do there. But you know what I do want to point out is the DOT releases a quarterly report on how they're doing, right? And when I did a little bit of analysis on it, and based on the last quarter and the previous quarters before that, we're actually making negative progress. So we're throwing more money. We're getting all these funds from Roadworks, and it's actually costing us more money, and we're doing more harm than good. When I was looking at the projects that are planned and awarded, they measure progress in terms of the different aspects of it by square footage for, you know, we're making this much square footage in improvements. And when you follow the trend of it, we're actually, we're making progress in certain areas, but overall, holistically to Rhode Island, we can't keep up with the crumbling infrastructure. So, you know, we're actually And the stat that I pulled up by that is, you know, we're doing great things. Apparently, we've got the Rhode Island DOT director saying we're doing all these projects. Hey, drive past here, you can see that. You know, I'm listening to your phone calls and doing this stuff. But our infrastructure crumbling is outpacing any growth that we're doing, and we have all the funds. We got roadworks was the big package, right? And all of a sudden, if we can't keep that level of sustainment up, what are we paying for? It's and to date, you know, I want to say, let's look at the budgets, right? So they're close to $700 million every year, and I can't go outside and see any of that progress.
So, Mike, what's the libertarian solution to my roads?
Well, that's something I was going to say, right? Like, so we talk about the tolls, right? Like, actually, tolling is actually a very libertarian solution to funding roadways, right? Like, because you're paying at the point of use, right? So you're actually paying to use the roads.
But where do those tolls go to? Where does the funds raised by those tolls actually go to, Mike?
That's the problem here in Rhode Island. Well, we started off with other funding mechanisms, right? We started off with gas tax, and then you got your licensing registration fees. I think at one point, didn't lottery have something to do with road financing? I'm not positive on that one, but there were all these different mechanisms to fund road infrastructure, but all that money just goes into the slush fund, right? And it just gets spent. So then when it comes time to fix the things, they're like, oh no, we have no money. We need more money. I think back to a kind of a joke used to be in the military with the Air Force was, you know, the general would get a budget to build an air base, right? And he'd go in and he'd build all the housing and the barracks and all the, you know, the facilities where, because the Air Force always had the best stuff, right? It was always nice. And then he'd build the airstrip last because he'd run out of money and say, oh, by the way, I ran out of money. I need money to build the airfield because we're an Air Force base. We have to have an airfield. So they're going to give us the money, right? Like, so it's one of those things. But then, you know, in our case, they just tack on tolls, right? So now we're going to have tolls for trucks initially, which we all know is the flip of a switch. Once it goes through the courts and the courts say, you can't just toll trucks. They say, okay, well, we're just going to flip the switch and toll everybody. So now you're paying gas tax, registration fees, and blah, 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 blah. So as far as libertarian, I mean, there's always the, and I think maybe Sean has some research on this, on privatizing the roads, right? You can always privatize them and use, different funding mechanisms for that. People say, how can you have a private road? Well, there's private roads all over the place. Have you ever driven to a housing development that's got, you know, a gated community? They've got private roads.
Like Disneyland has hundreds of private roads.
There's actual private roads in the United States. I believe there's a private, I think it's in Virginia. It's been a while since I looked it up, but they have a private expressway where you can, you know, pay extra to go onto this expressway and go through there.
If you ever go to the private bridge, if you go to the Santander headquarters off of Wampanoag Trails in Rhode Island, in East Providence, there's a private road that connects it behind where the Moses is heading over to Route 6. Is in the paper all the time too. So there's definitely local private roads that somehow get maintained.
Yeah. I was just mentioning Mount Hope Bridge was a private bridge when it was built. So there's another example. Like, it can be done. It's just we don't want to do it because if you can control the roads, then you can control all the money that goes into it and whatnot. So I don't know if Sean wants to add anything.
Yeah. Well, let me ask a question on that. Do those private organizations have their own Department of Transportation? Right. It's really hard to think about it because you have people, you have teams planning projects and doing all of those things, and they're still not being able to sustain and execute that type of stuff. You know, we should be really well positioned. You have people dedicated to it. Rhode Island spends more than most any other state, you know, per mile on the road. So it's not the money issue. It's literally the management of it. And I think it comes down to, you know, a lot of things that can be broadly applied to government. Right. So where's the incentive, right? They're not operating like a business to where they would be able to, worry about competition. They literally have a monopoly on pavement, on asphalt here for our roads. And without those influences, without those conditions being set, the state really doesn't have the incentive to be able to provide that value. They know that they have a task and they have to do this thing, and they're not going to be held accountable for poor performance. And I think that it might be difficult to imagine that type of scenario where you have private roads, because that's purely a government function, right? To worry about roads. But at the end of the day, if you don't have good service at a company, right, you're not going to go back there. People speak with their dollars, and unfortunately, we've lost our voice. That's the biggest thing here. We're extorted for these dollars. We see these dollars. All these federal dollars, our taxpayer dollars are getting funneled into these projects. If we want to go consume anything, if we want to purchase gas, there's a huge amount of gas tax that's applied there. And we're starting to lose that voice that we would have in a free market. And this is the case where they say, the state is too big to fail. If they don't perform, then they will get more funds for that project, or they'll ignore it and move on to the next one. If they plan a budget for $3 million for a bridge, they'll go over that and they'll spend $22 million on a bridge. And you can't even drive on it, right? You can't even ride your bike across it. You have to walk it across. It's
Something else to consider too. If the government wasn't building roads, what's to say that we wouldn't be living like the Jetsons by now, right? Like what makes you think that we would have to be using roads? We could all be flying in Jetson cars because we've advanced, because it was not the subsidized, way of transportation.
Well, Mike, it's funny you bring that up, because everybody loves to bash on Amazon and how much of a terrible corporation is, and they exploit their workers and everything like that. But you see the commercials they're putting out about their commitment to become carbon neutral by 2025. These are the things that the progressives are trying to get the government to force people to do, where a company here, either business-wise, strategically, or from a PR perspective, they're going ahead and voluntarily making these changes. They're investing in electric vehicle technology that will then become available to everybody in the free market. That's going to solve the problem in a free market way with no coercion, whereas you have the government forcing people, like the bill they just passed in Rhode Island, to meet certain mandates by certain dates. You end up having bad situations result from that.
That excellent point. Yeah. Anything else you wanted to add to that, Sean?
I don't know what else more there is to say about that. Yeah, I think it's really important to reflect that, this is just one example of a lot of the abuse that we see here. And it really is abuse. These funds could be going towards so many more things, but since we're so inefficient at doing that, every year we have to throw more money at these problems, and we're not seeing any results. So I don't know. There definitely needs to be some changes in this area. And I think I could use a couple more Dunkin' Donuts on the side of the road,
So something I forgot to add too, our topics now we're going to try to do is coincide with articles that we've written. So, and those will be published on libertyri.com. So Sean's got an in-depth article that he's working on that'll be published here shortly on the website. So that's going to be something that we're going to try to stick to from now on to increase content. And I had hinted earlier on how the roads could have distorted the market and innovation and whatnot. And Bill's got a good topic here about how government intervention distorts the market and screws things up. What do you got for us, Bill?
Well, certainly, this is something that's a little bit topical right now with the ongoing, we're celebrating getting past 12 months of being locked down during this pandemic. And currently, Rhode Island has just over about 7% unemployment rate. So despite driving around and seeing help wanted signs and all the business windows you can imagine when you're going up and down the street, or when you're going to the big box store, the grocery store, and you're waiting to check out, and there's like two people working in the to ring you out, and you're standing in line forever with the communicable disease supposedly floating in the air. So, it's impossible to get people even to count the number of people coming in and out of these stores to sit there because there's no incentive to work. A few weeks ago, I had a friend of mine, a business owner, posted on Facebook, and he described how he has open positions that he's been trying to interview for. And while he can get plenty of people to give him a call and show interest in the job itself, when he actually schedules the appointment for them to come to the shop to be interviewed, they don't show. And in the first few months of 2021, he's recorded over 100 scheduled appointments for employees that have just blown off their interviews. Now, think about a small business owner who's trying his hardest to keep the business afloat during a tough time, obviously short staff. That's why he's looking for additional people to come in. And now he's got to take the time to schedule and deal with people who don't show up for interviews. So that's just hurting him even more during this pandemic. I work in business to business sales, and I went to go meet with a restaurant owner in North Providence. And she mentioned how she couldn't get a woman to commit to come into the restaurant. And she was like, come in on Thursday. And she's like, oh, I got my kid on Thursday. I want to come in on Wednesday. And oh no, but I can't make it that day. And she goes, listen, just come in any day you want. I'll sit down with you. It had been a week later and she still hadn't shown up when I was talking to her about it. I don't know if anybody's trying to do work in their backyard, getting a contractor to show up. Geez, I mean, it's weeks for them to come out to give you an appraisal, let alone to when you get on their schedule to actually get the work done. So, you know, there's a lot of people calling, you know, complaining on Facebook or calling the radio and complaining to say, oh, well, it's more, people are making more money on unemployment than they actually are going to work. So I decided to pull some numbers and pull out my graphing calculator and do some math to figure out what exactly those numbers look like. Because it's something that people say, but you know, sometimes people just, it's something that people may not take seriously. So back when they were giving an extra $600 a month, back in the beginning of the government shutdown, they were getting that additional stimulus benefit on top of what they are legally allowed to get in Rhode Island, which is about 3.5% of somebody's quarterly earnings. Now, in order to get the maximum amount of unemployment through the state of Rhode Island, you need to be making somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, $67,000 a year, like just over $32 an hour, in order to that your quarterly wages equals the maximum benefit of $600 that you can get from unemployment. Automatically, everybody was getting the maximum. So right there, you know, instead of having about 50% of your actual income, which is unemployment, just to get you by so you have incentive to go find another job, you're immediately, in some cases, getting 100%, 150% of what your actual salary is. And, you know, I, like Mike said, we're going to share some of these articles online, and I kind of did the math out for you so you don't have to listen to me figure all this out. But it's amazing that even when the benefit get reduced to $300 a week, you do the math out and then you go ahead and you take the tax credit that these people are going to get for not having to pay their income, federal income taxes on the wages they received via unemployment. And it comes out to $15 an hour. And the numbers are just so amazing. And you think about our state government right now meeting in the General Assembly, and they're discussing and probably going to pass laws at a time when people can't petition their state representatives to go up and testify at these hearings and make their things. Not that the business owners could show up anyway, but the fact of the matter is, and it's whether it's planned or it just works out this way, these benefits have been extended until September 4th. And I just want to get your guys' reaction to see, what do you think is going to happen to the workforce in the state of Rhode Island? You know, what is this going to prevent people from actually hiring people? Are we kicking the bottom few rungs off the employment ladder? Are we creating an entire population of 40,000 people in Rhode Island that are getting paid and turning into a professional protesting class? I mean, what do you guys think about this?
You know, it's really interesting that you say that. You know, as I'm scrolling through Facebook, you know, sometimes you get very, very targeted articles. But something that I saw on that is that people and businesses are hurting to find qualified candidates now. And it's because of that. So it's the opportunity cost, right? Where you want to reopen, you want to put all this stuff out there. We're stalling a lot of the associated growth that we would expect to happen, especially, you know, as these regulations and restrictions are loosened, we find that people want to flourish. People want to get back into it. We're really just stalling growth. If people can't hire people to go provide more services, we're just going to kind of stall out here. And that's what we're going to see. We already know that the economy is going to be hurting for a long time. And if we can't get people back to work, I mean, why would people? That's the thing. If they could do something for less effort and still get paid, they're going to do it in a lot of cases. And it seems like a lot of the checks for those types of things have kind of gone down. I mean, and it's being abused left and right. You know, we could talk about real quick about some of the fraud that's been going on with some of those unemployment claims and things like that. And I don't have the stat on me, but I think it's been millions of dollars in fraud on top of the actual benefits that are going out to everybody. So people are exploiting the situation, and it's being given to them. right? And if it keeps getting extended, the very premise of that, of them extending these benefits out, just kind of shows that we want to stay in this situation. A lot of people are okay with the status quo now. It's okay to be in this type of position where you're not working, or it's okay to be in this position to not go and provide for these things because you have something like the nanny state that's going to be able to provide that to you, right?
Yeah, and another aspect of it too is what is I mentioned it earlier, the distortion it does in the marketplace, right? So how can a business compete with the government giving out money, like literally giving money away, where they have to, in order for them to get, you know, pay their employees, they have to generate, you know, a profit in order to pay their employees.
Or hire fewer employees, right, Mike?
Right. And you can't compete with that. So like that right there is a problem. And I've seen, it was an article, I think this past week, and I forget where the article was, but it was talking about restaurants giving signing bonuses now to try to entice people to come in. Again, now that's a distortion in the market, right? Like normally you wouldn't have to do that to get people off of unemployment to come work for you. But now you have to. So that money right there is money that could have been spent on growing the business and potentially hiring more employees. Now they're happy to get, you know, one or two employees instead of three, just because at least they'll get something, right? So like that just throws a wrench into the whole system. And also, as we know, like, so the federal money, you know, the bump up that's coming from the federal government, where's that money coming from? That's just being printed, right? So that's a tax on the future. Like you're going to pay for that at some point in higher costs, inflation, right? So, and then the money that's coming from the state out of the unemployment account, if you will, like that, how much is going to be there? And then when does that, I mean, I've not done any research on that.
Well, it's funny you bring that up.
It's
funny that you bring that up, Mike, because there's actually a trust fund or a fund that's associated with the unemployment insurance. And if you have times of extended unemployment, which I'm sure this qualifies as a time of extended unemployment, the federal government has a mechanism where you can borrow the money to keep your unemployment benefits funded to the level that they need to be. And actually, one of the last time we actually made payments, and it was a priority by libertarian Rhode Island Governor Link Chafee to pay off those loans, to eliminate that debt and to lower the cost of our unemployment insurance benefits, excuse me, because the higher amount you borrow from the government, the higher rates you pay to the government to reinsure those unemployment benefits. And to Mike, to your point about distorting the market, the per capita median income before the pandemic was $36,000 a year, about $17 an hour. When you work out to get what the actual benefits you get from unemployment plus the stimulus benefit plus the income tax break plus the additional stimulus payments that they're going out. But just it basically works out to, like I said, $15 an hour. So half of the employed people in Rhode Island, it's maybe not that high, maybe it's 40%, 45%, are going to make more money or the same money on unemployment than they would if they actually went to work. So why are they going to go back to work? How are you going to get them to re-enter the work market until there's this perfect storm where the benefits are set to expire in September? They've extended the length that you can get benefits to 75 weeks or 78 weeks or whatever the heck it is to bring you to that September 4th deadline, and everybody's going to run out. And what do you think they're going to do? They're going to extend the benefits because it's still an issue. People are still wearing masks. The governor, McKee, said we're going to stay in a state of emergency to make sure that we qualify for those federal funds in the future, because we don't want to cancel the state of emergency, because then the gravy train will stop coming from the federal government. And, you know, this really, like anything else, boils down to states' rights and states' issues, because in order to have the autonomy, you need to be able to fund these things and do these things as an individual state. As soon as you start relying on those federal dollars that are coming down the pike as part of the larger budget, there's a bunch of strings and conditions that the whack jobs up in Washington attach to those funds, and it ends up costing us more in the end. Not to mention that we're probably going to have to do a match to get the federal funding, and we don't have that in our budget. So we're borrowing to get that match, which is increasing our, and this is why the roads are so bad, Sean. I mean, this is all connected. It's just systemic abuse of the system.
Well, you know, if everyone's staying home so much, I don't know why the roads keep getting worse. You know,
lack of use. You got to maintain, right. You got to keep it. It's like a well-oiled machine.
Yeah, we don't want too much economic growth in Rhode Island. You know, the interesting thing that I just thought of is, you know, let's think pre-COVID, where people were complaining about, you know, the fight for 15 and jobs being replaced by kiosks in certain industries and things like that. But, you know, businesses are kind of forced to do that if they can't get the staffing. Right. So it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy here when, you know, you've got these types of solutions and they've kind of exploded in COVID. I went to a store the other day that was traditionally, you know, cashier based, and now it's been replaced with like 6, 7, 8 completely self-checkouts, you know, and I think we're going to see those trends. And when the workforce is ready, when all these restrictions are lifted and people are going to try to go back to work, they're going to find that those jobs aren't there anymore. And because the, you know, business owners and the market has had to innovate to cope and overcome some of these restrictions. So, you know, it wasn't out of the necessity of, you know, we're paying people too much. It was because they couldn't get people to do those tasks anymore. So, you know, the response to that, it's going to be very interesting to see when people try to reenter the workforce and they find that those jobs aren't there anymore. Now, there are going to be other tasks and other things for them to do, but is the workforce going to be qualified and ready to do all of those, available tasks at the time? And if we don't reopen, if we aren't able to facilitate that sooner rather than later, we're going to find that that's the climate. That's how these businesses are going to have to keep afloat, right? And they're going to find that, you know, a lot of these tasks
Just on that, a little bit off topic, but similar point, is the idea that the whole work from home thing, right? So how that is going to screw up the marketplace. So we've had these restrictions and the mandated to work from home. A lot of companies have sent their employees home, they're working from home. Whereas before they did that, they didn't do it. There wasn't as much of a focus on it because it was a learning curve, right? You had to get the technology up in place and the whole, the Zoom thing and, you know, Microsoft Teams or whatever your company is using. So there was less of a push to do that because there was no need, but now there is a need, and the workforce has learned and been trained to work from home. So what happens now to the commercial real estate market because of that, right? That's going to go into the toilet. And then all the supporting industries that supported the commercial real estate market, from, you know, cleaning companies that would come in and clean the office space at the end of the day and all these other things, which again, those people now are on unemployment, and, you know, are they going to be able to find a job, you know, because the market's not going to rebound. Companies are saving so much money having their employees work from home that they might as well keep doing it because they're trained to do it. So that learning curve has already been, you know, taken care of. So,
and any company that's been sitting on the fence deciding whether or not they want to invest in the capital expenditure of technology and automation, this is the catalyst that is pushing them over the edge, not to mention you're getting all of the federal funding, the PPP loans going to all these businesses. And again, the small ones who can't, you know, or who aren't qualified for as much money, so they're not going to be able to use it. They're just using it to pay, actually make the payroll and keep the lights on. You know, the small amounts, those businesses are just a finger in the dike of the entire problem and economic collapse we're in right now. It's the larger companies that are getting the large influxes of money that they can use. I mean, even if it's sent to payroll, that frees up money on their balance sheet that they can shift over to capital expenditures. And they're able to make these improvements in automation. And it's, like I said, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't think the people who are proponents for the $15 an hour minimum wage are going to like the results. They're going to end up entering the workforce when the stimmy money finally runs out, and they're going to find fewer jobs because people are paying the people who are left working more money, and there are fewer jobs to go around because the individuals are getting paid more, and the companies are going to rely more on automation. So it's really, it's going to be a tough pill to swallow at some point. And, you know, the Oversight Committee at the General Assembly really should be focused on looking at unemployment fraud and what's people who are taking advantage of the system and gaming the system, because, you know, what else are they doing? They're already their thoughts to get us to a $15 minimum wage is the chips are set in motion. Let's now make sure we're not hemorrhaging too much money and letting the tax dollars flow, as it were.
Yeah. Cool. So that wraps that up, Bill. Awesome. Yep. So another, since we're on the topic of big libertarian issues that we always hear about, another big one, legalization, right? So particularly cannabis legalization is always a big one that gets thrown back at libertarian, throwing their faces. Interestingly enough, here in Rhode Island, there's kind of a push. Well, so we already have, medical cannabis is legalized or allowed. And then we've decriminalized essentially personal use cannabis. So if you get caught with less than an ounce of weed, it's a civil fine. So essentially a parking ticket. There's no criminal, penalty attached to that. It's just a civil fine. So, as with every year, they introduced legislation this year, in the General Assembly for a legalization legislation, which in years past, I've always read through it, and it's always been a disaster, right? From a libertarian perspective. Again, we're going to look at this from a libertarian perspective. The libertarian perspective on legalization is basically the total decriminalization and descheduling of, and we'll just stick with cannabis for this, and treat it as, what is Larry Sharp says, treat it as an onion plant. I like, because we're here in Rhode Island, I like to say a tomato plant, but it's no different. It's just, treat it as a plant that you grow in your yard, right? That's not what they do in Rhode Island, right? And as we've seen, right, they're going to screw it up somehow. So the latest legislation, which is Senate Bill 0568, which was recently introduced back in March, and it has already gone through hearing, testimony, public hearing, and it's been held for further study. So we don't know if this is even going to come back again, but I think it was a worthy exercise to go through the legislation and see what they're trying to do this go around. So the bill itself breaks down into a couple of section categories. The first section is basically on the Cannabis Commission, that the bureaucratic body that is going to oversee the implementation and the enforcement of this new law. So it creates this whole new commission with people who are appointed by the governor. The commission itself then hires people to work for the commission. It's just this big, huge, bloated bureaucracy that's going to now need to be funded. And I'm sure they're going to use some of the money that's generated, which we'll get into how they're generating the tax revenue. But it's just this other bureaucracy that we have to keep an eye on, right? So that's the big one, right? That's kind of their how they start this off. The next big thing is how they're going to regulate the actual businesses that are going to operate, and they're going to break the businesses down into essentially four different categories, being the cultivators, the warehouses, or the wholesalers, and then the retailers, and then the laboratories that'll do the testing. And in my understanding of reading this, none of the different categories of businesses can be overlapped. So you can't be both a retailer and a wholesaler. You can't be a cultivator and a wholesaler. And it's my understanding that a retailer can't buy from the cultivator. They have to go through the wholesaler. So it creates this crony.
Just like the alcohol distributor, manufacturer, retail separation, that they do documentaries about how much that distorts the system and creates problems.
Yeah, and drives up the cost, right? Because every time another hand touches it, they're going to get their cut. It's going to drive the cost up and go from there. Well, interestingly,
That's really bad, though, right? Because if I recall the proposal, especially on the retailer side, you're only allowed so many licenses, right? You can only have so many of those retailers in existence in Rhode Island at this time. So that's going to absolutely drive up all the different prices. And those, the people downstream in that supply chain know that, if one of these 25 businesses want anything from this, they have to get
it. There's only three liquor distributors in Rhode Island, I believe.
Yeah, the way this legislation, this version of the legislation is written, is basically giving the commission the authority to determine how many licenses are available in the state. So it's, you know, again, it's another crony opportunity, right? Like, so you can start, you know, working deals on how many licenses are going to be issued and all this other nonsense. So it's just a very shady situation. So of course, each individual entity, if you will, each type of organization along that chain has to get both apply for a license and then pay for a license. So there's different application fees, and it's interesting. The cultivators, it's a sliding scale. So based on the amount of square footage that you intend to use to grow, is what your license is going to be. So everybody pays a set application fee, but then it's tiered. So you've got up to 1,000 square feet, it's an $80 application fee and a $250 licensing fee. And that's due annually, right? So the licensing fee is an annual thing, all the way up to 90 to 100,000 square feet. And I'm assuming above that, it's a $20,000 licensing fee and a $1,600 application fee. So quite interesting. And but it gets better. So then you go into the what they call the cannabis product manufacturer or wholesaler. So this is somebody who takes the raw material and they either turn it into a product or they wholesale it to a retail space. And you're looking at a $300 application fee and a $5,000 application fee. And that's going to be, again, annually. And then it goes down to the retail space, which is a $500 application fee and a $20,000 licensing fee. So it seems to be going up. And then you've got the laboratories that pay a $300 application fee and a $5,000 licensing fee. So again, so you've got all these fees on top of it, right? Which again gets passed on to the consumer because that's how it works.
And that keeps the inflated fees drive up the cost, which creates an incentive to maintain the black or the gray market where people are selling this stuff and you're really not resolving the problem by legalizing it in the first place.
Well, exactly. Right. So that becomes that whole problem. So the other interesting thing is, right, when you increase the cost, the other side of this is the taxing side. So they're going to regulate it. They're regulating the hell out of it. And then they're going to tax it. Right. So the taxing side of it becomes, you're going to pay a 7% sales tax on everything. Then you're going to pay a 10% excise tax, which goes to the state. So that's 17% right there to the state. And then each municipality is allowed to tack on another 3% for their own, you know, pockets, if you will, to line their pockets. So now you're increasing. So when you increase the cost, then you tack on, it just increases the tax revenue because of the high percentage that they got to pay on that. So it's absolutely insane.
You know, I'm curious about that now, right? So if someone wants to set up shop in Rhode Island and they've got these different things, I wonder how the zoning requirements are going to reflect those types of things. Oh, if you want to, you know, start anything with cannabis, you're then going to have to pay all this other stuff. And, you know, towns might be like, oh, I don't find that undesirable, or councils might be like that. And, you know, kind of expanded to, you know, the layers and layers of funds and more barriers to entry, right? You know, it, Mike, when you were talking about the license fees, it sounded like, you know, if you wanted to start really small scale, it didn't seem to cost that much. But if you wanted to actually, you know, grow in Rhode Island, already we're failing to launch, right? Because if I want to start small, then I want to get bigger, you know, the $20,000 license fee might be out of reach. So it might stifle me for years and years to kind of be kept inside of this box for cultivation. And then I'm never able to get to the next level with my business. And what does that do for Rhode Island, right? The only reason why they're pushing forward with this legalization stuff is because they're starving for funds, yeah, especially after COVID right now. So that's why they're really pushing it. But if we don't enable these businesses that want to come here and start these up to be able to do that, it's they're shooting themselves in the foot if they're trying to generate revenue off this, but they're stopping people from, you know,
yeah, so money. Add on to a couple of things you just mentioned there, that so municipalities will have the option to hold a ballot initiative to within their towns whether or not they want to allow cannabis facilities or retailers within their towns. So the town could vote no, and then nobody's allowed to start a business there, which is kind of messed up, right? Like, so you're not even allowed to open up shop to begin with. So they are giving that option to municipalities.
Well, this just opens the door for so much cronyism, doesn't it? Like, you know, these regulations and laws that get put on the books, and what you're going to end up having is a bunch of people who know the right people, know which gears to turn, knows what palms to grease to get the actual licenses themselves and actually benefit and profit from these inflated costs, because these fees are all going to someone. You know, there's somebody who's making money on this thing. Hey, if my, you know, 13-year-old buddy from high school could make a business out of selling pot, I'm sure the government can figure it out. And I mean, they're utilizing the same exact plan. If you think about it, you know, everyone's that's involved in the lower end production, distribution, retail, they're all kicking tribute up to the mafia dom up there to take their cut and to make sure that they're getting fat and happy from getting this. These new revenue in to plug all the holes for their misspending on every other aspect.
Well, what I find interesting too.
Yeah, and what's stopped? Oh, go ahead, Mike.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, with all these taxes and all these things that seem to contribute to the cost, what stops anyone from going to any of our neighboring states? You know what I mean? They're doing it now.
Yeah.
Nothing stopping anyone from going to Massachusetts and getting this stuff legally either.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I don't know. Rhode Island missed the opportunity for this. And in order to reap the most benefit, they got to get rid of some of these regulations. Yeah. They got to invite people to come start these types of businesses, whatever piece of the pie they want to do relative to cannabis. Well, they've got to get out of the way.
Didn't James Deosa get arrested in part of his indictment? The mayor of Fall River who had it was getting kickbacks for directing where these marijuana licensing is going to go. And the FBI raided his office and he's standing trial. So allegedly, I guess, but I mean, come on, this is just opening the,
that's not going to happen in Rhode Island.
Happen in Rhode Island whatsoever. Give me a break.
Another interesting aspect of it, which doesn't make sense to me on this, in as far as the regulation goes, is if you're a retailer, you're not allowed to get a license to be a cultivator. Like, so no entity is allowed to have multiple licenses. So if you want to like cut your costs by both growing it and selling it at retail, you cannot do that. So they're building in a unnecessarily complex structure to raise the cost. Like they're doing it on purpose, it seems, with the exception of, I believe so medical marijuana facilities or medical cannabis facilities are allowed to sell up, according to legislation, will be allowed to sell up to 50% of their product to regular customers, personal use customers, non-medical customers. And they are also allowed.
Like that's gonna get abused.
Say again?
You know? No, I have a feeling that's going to get abused, Jerry, if you're letting only certain people sell to certain people there, right? You know, I know it's something that me and my family would like to do. We like to go to the different farms and farm stands here in Rhode Island. And I would love to be able to take someone's product right from their own fields. We do it with everything else, you know? Mm-hmm. You made the reference to onions, right? We could go grab our apples the same way. It's just, I feel like it's, we're really losing out on an opportunity. And the way that Rhode Island kicks this off is going to set the tone for the business climate for this industry, and other industries are watching too. Right. So, you know, what we're doing in one area, it could hurt. Or if, we find that something's really effective in terms of, well, we have this extra tax for marijuana, what stops the state from saying, oh, well, we're getting that. We could just put that on these other products like that come from the farms. We could do it to apples. We could do it to all these different products because they found another revenue source, right? So, oh, I could just put a 5-10% tax on it. You're not going to miss that money that much. You know, maybe we'll fill up a pothole.
It'll all go into the general fund too, right, Sean?
So, well, that's the thing. All the tax revenue does, it specifically says in the legislation, go to the general fund. So
it's a black hole, right? The black hole, yeah. In the Rhode Island state government. Do we have restricted accounts in the Rhode Island state government? I think there's a few, I mean, up there, but geez, it's amazing.
Not anymore. Not with all these emergency access permissions to do spending and incur debt that, you know, they set the tone for that in COVID, right? At the very beginning, they got permission to, you know, spend as much as they want. And really, they don't really check up on that. So imagine another revenue source coming in. No one's going to be watching any of that. They're setting some ourselves up for a lot of
current. Sounds like we're getting I was going to say, it sounds like we're getting all of the negative aspects of it and none of the benefits of it because we're too busy shooting ourselves in the foot before we can even get started.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a couple of just final points. So some of the, two other aspects of this. I'll hit on the personal use aspect last, although it's not last in the legislation, just because that's I'll kind of try to end on a little bit of a positive note. But there's also, so without describing the personal aspect of it, there are still civil penalties for certain violations of the legislation. And those penalties go to a fund. And let me pull this up so I can say it appropriately. Let me see. It's the Social Equity Assistance Fund. So there's a social equity aspect to this legislation.
Of course, and there is.
talk about more cronyism, right? So the idea behind this, as far as I understand it in the reading, is that there have been certain communities have been affected more heavily than others in the war on drugs, which we all know is a fact, right? So that is legit, but they want those communities to now be
get the most cannabis.
Yes, so they want the industry to thrive in those communities. Oh. So they're using this fund to help people within those communities start businesses, so they can get money from this fund to help them start their businesses in these overly burdened communities from the war on drugs. So I thought that was kind of interesting. There is a social equity aspect of this, of course, that they're pushing. But just from the aspect of personal use, right? So actual possession, they've gotten a little bit better in this area, where in years past, what they've done is, like, as I said before, if you had under an ounce, I can look up, I have the law here in Rhode Island. If you have, currently, if you have less than an ounce, it's a civil violation, $150 fine, like a parking ticket. Doesn't go on your criminal record or anything like that. If it's between 1 ounce and 1 kilo, it's a misdemeanor and it's a $500, $500 fine and up to a year in prison. And then if it's over between 1 to 5, kilos, it's a felony and it's a mandatory 10-year sentence, up to 50 years and $500,000 fine. And then more than 5, it's a mandatory 25-year sentence and $100,000 fine. So that's as it stands right now. So essentially, in years past, what they've done is the legislation has basically gotten rid of the under 1 ounce penalty, civil penalty, but it for the most part kept the criminal penalties above an ounce. So you were still better off just keeping this and paying the $150 fine instead of risking having over an ounce and you're still going to get screwed anyway. So it's like, it didn't make sense the way they did it before, but this legislation essentially eliminates all that, although it still does create it allows you to keep an ounce. Now, I believe it's up to 6 plants per in the house per adult, up to, with a maximum up to 12. So if you have 2 adults living in the house, you can have up to 12 plants. And if there's 3 adults, you're still only maxed out at 12 plants. Again, it's a whole bunch of different rules and variations, but the civil penalties are, if your possession of over an ounce, it's a civil penalty. I think it's $100. Again, anything that's above what's allowed becomes a civil penalty as opposed to a criminal penalty. So that is a step in the right direction. Although, again, why not just let people have what they want to have? It's a freaking plant. Why do that? I think it's a money grab, right? It's a way to grab money. And it's so arbitrary, right? Like it just doesn't, it doesn't make sense. So
yeah, it doesn't even seem like it's really legalized at that point. No. Right. You know, it's definitely a step in the right direction, but you know, I'm going to give a little bit of free advice to Dan McKee and Peter Alviti. I think they should join forces on this one. Hear me out, guys. And they should launch an initiative called Pot for Potholes. You know, if they say that, having funds, we need more money for the DOT. If they put in to reduce the regulations and enable more people to, you know, purchase cannabis, and if we could reduce the regulations on that, if we could reduce some of the other regulations that are related to some of the, you know, the stuff that Bill talked about right now, right? If we're able to reduce that type of stuff, you will generate more income and just let people do it. Let people, you know, put their dollars in play for this type of stuff. And they will flourish after that. Free advice, way better than cool.
Well, I said the same thing. You're talking about in the gold rush out west, the people digging for gold never got as rich as the people that went up and set up the general store in the shanty town out there that sold everything you needed for a hefty profit. I mean, these are the type of things where we need to get the state out of the way, let the electricians, the HVAC contractors, the distributors of the growing equipment, the lighting, everything that goes into this type. It could be a cottage industry, just in the fact that, you know, maybe someone wants to grow something in their own home and make sure that they grow a garden in their backyard. Why not be able to grow responsibly, you know, a couple cannabis plants in your basement or something like that? There's nothing really wrong with that. And you could have a cottage industry of people coming, like they come to install a backup generator, they'd come and help you install your small little grow operation, and creating these new job opportunities in these new markets. Instead, they're restricting it to the smaller and smaller number of people, and they're trying to fit the new problem or the problems that they foresee are going to arise with this new innovation or this new introduction into the market. And they're trying to fit it into the ways of the past, where everything is bureaucracies and there's certain licensing processes that go into place. And the same people who are in stasis right now, collecting all of the benefits from these barriers that are up there, are going to remain in power, and you're really not going to see any systemic change.
Yeah.
I think we should treat it more like some other states are treating breweries, right? We've seen a much larger, you know, rise in microbreweries, and we're starting to see that in Rhode Island too. How did that start? We started reducing the burden of doing business in that industry in Rhode Island. We started reducing regulations, and now we've got more microbreweries popping up. You know, in states like New Hampshire, they even have nano breweries where you have, you know, people that are home brewing essentially and being able to sell small batches of beer. And then what they're finding is that those people that are starting as nano breweries are growing into microbreweries. And then it's getting larger and larger, and there's more economic growth coming in because you're reducing the barrier to entry there. We could do the same thing for cannabis here. It's the same exact concept.
Yep. Yeah. And yeah, on that note, I kind of wrap it up. I think overall the legislation, and there's a lot more detail I'll put in the article, some kind of quirks and weird things that are going on in the legislation. Overall, I think it's like a D- from a libertarian perspective, would be a no vote. I mean, granted, the big plus in this is they're not throwing people in cages for possession, but they're still taking their money. You know, that's not a good thing, but at least they're not throwing them in a cage. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous that's like the kind of compromise that you have to say is a good thing. It's insane, but based on years past and other legislation that have been proposed, but the overregulation of the industry is absolutely a no-go. And the whole redistributive mechanism in it. One other thing is expungement. I want to hit on that. So if you've been convicted of a possession with intent to distribute of under an ounce, I think it was a 1 ounce, you get expunged. But above that, you're still got a criminal record, as far as I could tell, in reading what it was describing. So that again is a no go. Like why not let everybody? Wow. Like if everything
for a second there, Mike, I thought you were actually going to say they were doing something really good in this.
Yeah.
Right. Is being able to expunge it, period. You know, especially for something like cannabis, right? If we're about to legalize it,
yeah.
What's the difference if the guy had an ounce or over an ounce?
Yeah.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Especially since now over an ounce is just a traffic ticket, right? Essentially a civil infraction. So like it absolutely makes no sense. I'll leave that one at that. We'll have the article up on the site here in the next few days, but, yeah. So I guess that wraps up our first episode of the new Rhode Island Liberty Report.
Yay.
Yeah, that went well.
I like it.
Guys did an awesome job. So we're going to try to do this on a every other week basis is what we're committing to. So hopefully our schedules can accommodate that, and we can keep that workflow going. So that's something to look forward to for everybody that's listening now. Couple of things again to wrap it up. So we want to reiterate connecting with us on libertyri.com/connect. That's where you can get all of our social media links and our newsletter and our email page contact form. Also, as always, subscribe to us on Apple and Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, all the major podcatchers. And please don't forget to rate us and leave a review on those, because that really helps boost us and get people to find our podcast and tune in and listen. So I guess until next time, thank you to Bill and Sean. Great, great work with you guys.
Yeah, thank you. And
we will be talking to you soon.
You've been listening to the Rhode Island Liberty Report. Be sure to check us out at libertyri.com.